You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herd's here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our fourth week discussing Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders, and that is because this week we are talking about the screen adaptations thereof, this classic novel. The Taxman was a little on the fence about how much Agatha Christie we'd done, and so Herd's, here we are, doing just a little bit more.
We need to keep that Taxman off the fence. He keeps getting over. We need a bit of a bigger fence, I think. That's the reality of the situation.
So Herds and I have both watched the ITV David Suchet version of this, and then we each picked one other iteration to watch. I watched the BBC version starring John Malkovich and Rupert Grint. And Herds, what incarnation have you done?
Hold on! It's not what I've done. It's what Frank Tashlin has done. I watched The Alphabet Murders, which is a 1965 adaptation. The term adaptation is being applied loosely to this situation. It is more of a comedy than a mystery because Frankie Boy made comedy films, slapstick. He's not a suspenseful mystery guy. He's let's have Hastings get stuck in the boot of a car and then locked inside of the trunk for a large part of the third act of the film. The joke is that he's fat. It's great. Yeah,
we're going to keep spoilers pretty light here at the start of the episode and then dive in towards the end. So we'll talk a little bit more stylistically to begin with and then adaptation specific later on. But yeah, generally, I think one of the interesting things is, as is often the case, the ITV version was very, very true to the original story. Although they did get rid of Inspector Chrome from the ITV version, which was a very interesting choice.
I mean, does Inspector Chrome exist in the other version you watched, the ABC version of the ABC Murders?
So, interestingly, they do the opposite thing to the ITV version in some senses.
Yes.
Inspector Chrome is played by Rupert Grint, and Jap dies of a heart attack.
That's very interesting. Very bizarre. Why is that? Is that part of the crime, or is it just some added drama?
No, he's retired. He's old. They're sort of introducing Crone as like the new upstart who doesn't trust Poirot. That's like the hook for their relationship. It's not that he's like a rugged old inspector who wants things done his way. It's that he's the new upstart who doesn't believe in the old religion of Poirot.
Oh, really? Oh, that's fun. That's a fun angle. Well, in the Alphabet Murders, as far as I can tell, there also isn't an Inspector Crone. But there is Inspector Jap. His introduction is being assaulted by Poirot. Poirot sees someone hiding behind a curtain during the Betty murder, and he goes, "I found your killer!" And he hits him with his walking stick, his cane.
It's
amazing.
Adaptations of Poirot trying to be funny and having Poirot commit assault by walking stick.
Well, this is the thing, right? I don't know how your ABC production of the ABC Murders was, but the thing that stood out to me for the Alphabet Murders was that, you know how we keep talking about how David Suchet like revolutionized portrayals of the character as someone more serious
and nuanced?
Yeah,
because Christie always found that they were too silly.
They were.
They kind of took the character as
and
a joke.
And I've finally seen concrete proof that that is the case, because Poirot in the Alphabet Murders is ridiculous. Apparently, in an original version of the script, there was to be a, quote, bedroom scene with Poirot that Christie strongly objected to.
It's kind of weird to think that, like, Agatha Christie was alive to only see the worst adaptations of her own work.
I'm so sad. It's really a shame. I need to talk about cuss in the Alphabet Murders.
Well, as I understand, there is no cuss in the Alphabet Murders, Herds.
Well, I mean, sort of. There is an Amanda Beatrice Cross, played by starring Anita Ekberg, who was a very popular actress at the time, who seems to
Herds,
play...
Herds, are you telling me that they replaced the epileptic, war-addled veteran with a buxom blonde?
Yes, that's exactly what's happened. And
it's
I need
terrible.
To be clear, her introduction is that Poirot is at a massage parlor. He's just had his spa, and now he's lying down on the massage table. And ABC, Miss Cuss, as it were, Miss Cross, walks up behind him, puts her hands on his shoulders and starts giving him a massage and says, "I'm going to kill someone." And this is the replacement for the letters.
Oh my God, it's just like Sophie Hannah's The Mystery of Mr. E.
It's bizarre. It's a unique approach, to be sure, and that is an apt comparison. It's weird that both of those stories have crossed my path at the same time. But yeah, there's a lot of changes to the story, such as the removal of the letters and the role of Cust. She wanders in. She's selling balloons to Poirot. That's how she appears in lieu of the second letter. There's lots of things that have been changed in order to kind of accommodate Anita's appearance in the film. And if you actually look at advertisements from the time, she is like three times the size on the poster of Poirot and Hastings, who are, you know, also on the cover. It's bizarre. It's a big example of like star power trumping the actual characters in the story. It's wild.
Well, yeah. The other big change we have in the BBC version is that Inspector Chrome, as well as not believing in the old religion of Poirot, sort of has this plot thread where he believes that Poirot actually did the crime. And there was this interesting sequence in the first episode where they actually go to Poirot and confiscates all of his documents to try and prove that he is the killer, except I don't know what happened next because the streaming service I was watching it on removed the episode while I was in the middle of it.
What? Oh no. That's
it
bizarre,
was a
mate.
Cool idea, right? Like, you know, the detective being thought to be the killer because they know too much is not something that we haven't seen in crime fiction, but it was a compelling little change to the plot and kind of ramped up the stakes that Chrome provided to the story. But
I mean, it's a bit of a play on the original.
I can't tell you what happens.
It's a bit of a play on the original plot, isn't it? And having someone framed for a crime they didn't commit, it kind of lends to the themes, I think.
Yeah.
That would have been cool to see, just to add to the insanity of the alphabet murders. Hastings is no longer a very good friend of Poirot.
Oh, no.
Which is strange.
He's not even in the guardian. BBC version.
Really? He's just out entirely?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I wonder if it's like a running theme with these adaptations. They don't know what to do with Hastings because he's like the narrator and doesn't actually do
well. Yeah, he's the narrator, and as we were talking about with Sophie Hanna, he's sort of the voice of reason. And if you have the camera being the voice of reason, then what's the point of him?
That's true. Why not just cut him out and say he was stalking Poirot the whole time in order to film his life and times?
Is that what they do?
No, that was just a postification.
that would actually be funny for the alphabet murders.
If the camera just like gets fumbled in his hands and we get a shot of like looking at Hastings like, oh no, I'm on the film. That'd be great. No, so Hastings in the alphabet murders is, I don't fully understand. I only watched the one episode, but he's a guardian of Poirot. And he keeps saying that the British people and Her Majesty would be very sad if anything were to happen to him. So he's apparently acting in the interests of the Queen, to protect Poirot from his own foolishness. So it's a slapstick bit, right? You got Hastings trying to stop Poirot from getting into trouble, but of course Hastings is always in more trouble than Poirot ever is because Poirot keeps locking him in boots of cars with women who have no name and don't appear in the story ever again. I feel like in the context of where he is in the books, it's very strange.
I think the other big change to characters that always tends to happen in Poirot adaptations is that the BBC version does concern itself perhaps too much with Poirot's background.
I mean, it's part of trying to kind of translate the impression that you get from novel after novel of Poirot to one film or one episode, right?
Yeah. John Malkovich does play a much more straight Poirot than a lot of other adaptations, and I think he does a like really good job of it. It's a very tight performance, but it still can't get away from that like modernization that you're talking about there, where they just have to explain things.
Well, thankfully in the Alphabet Murders, I should say it's Tony Randall as Hercule Poirot. He's very emotive. He does a lot of leaping around and comedic nonsense. I think it's fine. I was curious, there is one aspect of the story that is completely omitted from the alphabet murders because it would just make things too complicated. Diving clowns in full makeup, totally fine. We'll get to that in the spoiler section. The diving clown is spoiler section only.
What now?
Believe it or not. It's the first murder. AA is a clown who is shot as he's performing his diving act. He's practicing in full makeup. That's just what he's doing. Anyway, well, I did have a question because this was omitted completely from the alphabet murders. Was there a legion formed in the BBC production?
I don't think so, no.
Interesting. Yeah, because that didn't happen in the alphabet murders either.
Anyhow, we should roll over. We'll discuss spoilers and mystery shenanigans in the last part of the show.
So ready.
Stick around. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. We are discussing screen adaptations of Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders. Don't go anywhere.
Watch out for diving clowns.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. Now, a couple of years ago, we spoke with Vanda Simon, Craig Sisterson, and Lindy Cameron of Clandestine Press about the collection Dark Deeds Down Under, featuring several series indicative stories from Australian and New Zealand crime writers, both past and present, sharing kind of the best of our short story writing from the best of our long fiction authors. Dark Deeds Down Under 2 is very soon on our doorsteps, on our bookshelves, and I'm joined by two of the legendary authors who are contributors to that collection, Nat Conyer and Chad Taylor. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's very exciting to be talking to you again, Felix.
Yes, thank you. I've never been called a legend before, but I'll go with that. That's very kind.
Yeah, Craig assures me it is the right word.
Not real.
So the both of you have contributed, as I said, stories to this collection. Nat, yours is called The Uniform. Chad, yours is Vacancy, each tying in to the worlds of your broader fiction. Chad, we'll start with you, especially considering the 13-year gap in your published career. You tell us a little bit about how you kind of came to pick this story. Why was this the short story you chose for this collection?
The story that I wrote, I'm sitting around for a while, Vacancy, it's called, and you know, it used to be easy to place things like that, or there used to be more opportunities to place things like that. And sometimes you just have an idea that sits nicely in a short form. This is one of those ideas, you know, this is a chance to sort of get that idea out. I just had this idea about someone working in forensics, you know, and I think there's a lot of cliches in crime. And I just thought maybe the person working in forensics is just sort of young and professional and untroubled. And that contrasts with the fate of the victims, and it sort of started from there, really, just thinking about location and origin and the places where people live and where they die and where they end up. Craig, when I was chatting to him about a year before, and he said, oh, you know, would you like to contribute something? And I think it probably would have been better for him if I had something a bit more straight down the middle, but I just wanted to give something, I'll put something out that was a little bit left of center, you know? And that's really where most of my writing ends up. I don't fit too well in a box.
And then, Nat, your story, The Uniform. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to pick that one?
Lindy asked us to write a short story which featured the protagonist of our novel. And I had just written this novel. I grew up in South Africa, and the novel I'd written had a hero called Skalk Lawrence, a cop in South Africa. But I was thinking of writing another book, and I wanted to set it in Sydney, and I wanted a Sydney protagonist. And I thought of a lady, a woman, female cop, a homicide, that stage, a sergeant. And she came to me sort of, her name is Jackie Rhodes. Mm. And the short story was really a way of exploring Jackie when she first started to become a cop. So that's where that came from. And it was just an experiment in learning about the character, because you learn about them as you write them.
Well, yeah, my understanding was that Skalk Lawrence and Jackie Rose were kind of turning into a collective series. How's that going? Where's the next book along the line?
The second book's done, and Echo Publishers are going to bring it out in September, and I'm busy going through the page proofs now. And I'm busy on my third. And the second one brings Skalk to Sydney, and it's a joint Skalk and Jackie book. And I can't say anything about the third one because it's in total chaos at the moment.
Such is story writing. I guess, Chad, for you, do you feel like you learn a lot about writing for full-length fiction when you put stories into these really tight packages like The Vacancy?
Well, I started off writing short stories. I mean, I love short stories, you know, and I think so many of us, when we, as readers, you know, that's some of the first good literature that you read. I remember when I was really small, I had a book of, was given a book of horror stories, you know, as you do when you're a kid, you get classics of present. And one of them was The Hand by Guy de Maupassant. And it was very soon after that, I thought, wait, he's like a real writer. He's not just like a horror writer, you know. And so I sat down and sort of read, I think it was Bellamy or something like that. There's such a rich world out there of books and writing, and it's hidden from people now. You know, it's hidden behind an algorithm or just whatever's been consumed in the moment. And Yeah, I've just always liked the form. I like the challenge of fitting a whole lot of detail into just a few pages. And you can explore ideas that, you know, maybe they only go as far as the story, but it's interesting to try and give it a resonance that lasts beyond that.
Well, yeah, talking of that resonance, Nat, I guess for you, Jackie Rose being a character you're writing into a future piece of fiction, why was this the story of hers that you chose to tell in The Uniform?
I was just at the start of writing the Jackie book. She's got a father who was a very famous cop in Sydney. He helped clean up the Cross, you know, the Cross in the 70s and 80s, all the underbelly stories was phenomenally corrupt. And my idea was that Jackie's father, Stanton Rose, had gone in undercover and had worked in a very dangerous area and sort of done the foundation work for the Royal Commission. And I thought, well, okay, she's now working as a cop. She's got this famous father. You know, it was just a case of getting to know her. I started off with her just after she started, just, you know, she's not even used to her uniform.
And then, Chad, I guess Nat's talking about bridging fiction that she wrote originally based in South Africa and tying it in with these new Sydney characters. For you, New Zealand's always been a part of your voice, kind of despite the fact that writing noir outside of traditional noir settings wasn't as prevalent back in kind of the early part of your career. What's always pushed you to write fiction that spoke so, I guess, authentically New Zealand?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've been accused of the opposite. Not accused, but classified as the opposite. You know, people sometimes say my writing voice is American, or I don't think that it is. When I sort of started out in the late 80s, early 90s, no one was writing about the city. The theme of the city connected me to writers overseas who wrote that way. I don't know. I've always been interested in writing about the New Zealand that's part of a larger world. You know, I'm not interested in writing about people angsting in paddocks and stuff. You know, you write what you know, you write it, you stick to it. If people see something in it, that's great, but you have no control over that, really. It's very hard to judge.
And in terms of the rest of the collection, is there anything else that you particularly were excited to see in this collection? What else can we see in Dark Deeds Down Under 2, the best of Australian and New Zealand, supposedly?
In addition to stories by new authors, there are a couple of stories by very established people, and one of them is Dorothy Porter, who wrote a crime novel in verse, The Monkey's Mask. And I'm not sure if this is a short story or an extract from The Monkey's Mask. It's a long time since I've read it. I actually taught with Dorothy Porter. We both taught at East Sydney Tech. I was reminded of how fantastic a poet she is. And then there's a short story that comes to mind by Emma Viskic. I think that's how you say her name, about a woman fleeing an abusive relationship with her. And the story has this amazing twist. Where do I start? There are so many good stories.
I think one of the ones I was most excited to see was Jack Heath, but I am a little bit disappointed that we didn't actually get a Jack Heath children's novel crossover in The Bad Listener. Would have been something a little fun and silly.
That would have been actually fantastic. There's a terrific story by Robert Gott, which has an actor, and the language in it is quite formal.
I know, I was so excited to see Robert Gott back in the world of actors, back in the world of William Power.
It's something I always like with crime novels. There's a tradition of, you know, like you tend to hear about whatever the author is reading or eating or listening to at the time. And it's a nice sort of casual thing with crime that I think is one of the good things about the genre.
Yeah. Well, this is a William Power story and it's one of my favourites.
Well, Nat, Chad, thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader to talk a little bit about Dark Deeds Down Under 2.
Glad to be here. It's great to be in a collection. It's great to have some work out. Craig has always been a really strong advocate for, you know, that sort of genre in New Zealand, and it's just nice to be on board.
Dark Deeds Down Under 2 is out this March with Clandestine Press, and thank you so much to Lindy Cameron for sending over a copy of that book for us to read, and an enormous thank you to the editor, Craig Sisterson, for putting us in touch with Nat and Chad for this interview. We'll have links up on the podcast if you want to find out anything more about the collection and the just waterfall of talented authors in both this and the previous iteration of the collection. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing The ABC Murders by Agatha Christie and some film adaptations thereof. Stick around, more to come on your Murder Mystery World Tour. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing screen adaptations of Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders. Just after following on from the book, we're talking spoilers and the mystery in this section of the show, so ye be warned.
Watch out.
And Herds, I need to know,
what do you
how
need to
many
know?
Kills did they add to the alphabet murders?
None. Actually, hold on. Oh, that's a good question. There's a final kill. So I guess they added one. I'm trying to remember who it actually was that got killed, but it's whoever was going out with Franklin, because actually it's actually Amanda who wants to be with Franklin. So Franklin kills his other girl and then ends up with Amanda, who is arrested. But she fakes. So what? Here's the thing. So the first four kills happen. The first kill is a clown man because of plot reasons as he's diving into a swimming pool. The fourth kill is DD. Because they introduce a psychologist character so that they can explain the schizophrenia angle that they're playing with Amanda Beatrice Cross, because she's crazy now. She's crazy.
Of course.
It's terrible.
Of course.
And they're like, aha, I see the fourth kill must be Duncan Doncaster or whatever.
Yeah, no, the one they add to the BBC one is Dexter Dooley.
That's pretty good.
And Ernie Edwards.
Oh, God. But yeah, there's the plot twist is that Carmichael Clarke has been killed. Franklin is the character that I actually care about. He ends up on a train with his love, and they're like, ah, ha, ha, we totally got away with those murders. And then he gives her a cigarette or a drink or something, and then she dies. That's the additional kill. So it's not even an alliterative kill. It's just a strange twist for the sake of twists.
No, they have a couple of extra kills in the BBC version. It stays pretty by the book in the ITV version.
It does. It's good.
With David Suchet. But the one scene I did want to talk about, spoiler-wise, that was just the best of anything I've seen from adaptations of this book was the scene with Alexander Bonaparte cussed in prison in the ITV version with David Suchet.
You mean the best scene?
The best is so good.
Yeah.
You know, in the novel, they have this scene where they sit down and Poirot sort of interrogates Cust. And in the book, it's played as tense, a little cross. It seems like Cust is a little like scared and angry that he's ended up in this position. Whereas the way that it's played in the ITV version with Donald Sumpter playing Alexander Bonaparte Cust is just impeccable.
Watching him kind of playing this supposedly insane character and watching him kind of move between the total mental breakdown that he's having and then when he's talking about playing the dominoes, we have a flashback sequence where I believe Poirot is just talking about Cust and they're playing video of the two of them playing the game together.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool, especially since this adaptation, I think, leans a lot more on the game aspect of the narrative, which I really like.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that is kind of shoved in at the end of the book is talking about the fox being caught in the hut and how cruel that would be, and talking about how it isn't sporting. And I thought that was kind of an undercooked sort of theme there. But with the way that Cust plays dominoes and talks about dominoes in the film, I think they do a really good job of driving home that, like, the way that the criminal is going about doing the crime is they're pretending it's a game when it's not a game. They're like completely faking all of the rules. They're saying that they're like playing by the rules of things when they're not. Whereas Cust, when he plays dominoes, he genuinely enjoys playing by the rules of dominoes and demonstrating his ability to play the game, whether or not he wins or loses. And I like that that is juxtaposed with the criminal's actual mindset, where it's not about being fair.
The one line that Donald Sumpter delivers to just absolute perfection is when he says, oh, there's such play in it.
Yes.
When Poirot asks him about the game. And you can just see that, like, even though the tone of the scene doesn't change overtly, there's this like sense of hope and camaraderie that's been introduced to it. And we were talking with Sophie Hanna about like what made Cust not work in the book. And I think it's because you really have to read Cust's tone generously for him to be an interesting and likable character. And the way they adapted that into the show, I think, is like the reading that works best of the text.
Mm. Or you could just make him a sexy, blonde, schizophrenic, psychopathic, love-struck, etc.
You're so true. And maybe we could throw in Miss Marple there as well, just for a fun little twist at the end.
Yeah, well, she is in the film. Only for a moment. It's not a proper crossover episode, but there's a moment where Poirot he's walking up the stairs to the building, and we hear Miss Marple say, "Oh, the solution to the murder is simple. It's as simple as ABC." And then she like looks at Poirot as they pass each other. And I believe that the actress who played Miss Marple here, she's uncredited, Margaret Rutherford. She's played the character in the past. So it was kind of a nod to her career playing the character, which is great.
The Christie Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, the Christie Cinematic Universe begins with ABC. How fitting.
The other thing I'm interested in is one of the parts that was sort of weird and unsatisfying and a little lacking in solidity mm-hmm. in the book was the way that they actually pin Cust, because effectively they get him to confess by believing they have enough proof, but they don't. It's him trying to shoot Poirot that basically allows them to even arrest him in the first place.
Which doesn't happen in the ITV version.
It doesn't. And in the BBC version, they just have his fingerprints, and he gives Poirot a brandy to thank him for arresting the criminal, and that's how they get his fingerprints to compare it to the typewriter.
It's very clever. Kind of misses the irony of that scene, but at least it's like a clue that makes sense. Can I tell you the equivalent in
absolutely, that's what I'm fishing for.
I'm glad. It's a good thing you're here to go fishing, because our lovely lady has just ended up in the water. So the clue that Poirot uses to figure out what's going on is that we have our fifth death in the story. I say death, not kill. It's Amanda throwing herself from like a construction crane into water. But thankfully, she had off-screen diving lessons with the clown that she shot in the first scene of the film.
Oh, no.
And that's how Poirot figures it out. He says, "Oh, you went to Switzerland not to see the countryside, but to have diving lessons with this diving clown. And that's why you shot him." So the only character who is killed, who isn't killed for a reason, is BB. And I don't know why she was killed in that case. Like it's the inverse of the premise of the story, which is a really weird thing to do. And I feel like it was just because they wanted to like zazz it up. I'm glad at least that even if we've ended up with a couple of very strange, intense or comedic adaptations, that at least the ITV version seems to be somewhere in between. It seems like it's kind of the gold standard.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that any time you're comparing any Poirot adaptation, ITV and the team that they put together to make that show really went for making Agatha Christie's Poirot adapted for the screen, whereas most other renditions are making their own Poirot for the screen.
Sure.
And I really enjoyed the BBC version. The performances, I thought Eamon Farron, who plays Cust, was an interesting choice, because he conveys a very different aura to the way that Donald Sumter does it in ITV.
Yeah.
I think it's always interesting comparing them, and it's always interesting seeing how many different people can take away such different things from the same text that we've just read.
True. Also, I should mention, just because this is a very fast look, I cannot fit all the facts I know about this film into this episode, but also Poirot figures out the murders before they happen in this version of the story. I just want to let you know. It figures out
of course,
the third and fourth episodes.
The detective must be so smart that he's boring.
Yeah, he literally figures out that Carmichael Clarke is going to be killed and goes to warn him twice. And during the second time, when they're in public in like a restaurant, he gets shot in the neck. It's a great time. Highly, highly recommend watching it, possibly with friends.
Well, Hertz.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
With our taxes out of the way, it's time for our other regular obligation
all
on
right.
the show, I hear.
Yeah. I've lined us up. I've gotten in contact with some people who've been in contact with our people. I have in front of me a copy of The Mystery Writer by Solari Gentil, friend of the show, owner of the Golden Dance Pants. She has come for your blood this time. And yeah, we're going to be doing that one next. So we are going to be covering from chapters 1 to 14.
There we go. It is time to dive in
on
to Solari Gentil's latest book. I'm excited for this one. I wormed my way through the first 10 chapters before it ended up being that I was going to solve it on the show. So
we got a head start.
I'm excited to see where we go from here.
I'm ready for it. I'm really excited to see what kind of nonsense you come up with this time.
It is one more round of metafiction unto the breach. True. Thank you for joining us as we discussed Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders. We'll be back with Solari again until next week on your Murder Mystery World Tour. Woo! This is Death of the Reader, and you're listening to 2SER 107.3.
Dive on in.